We move to the last case today, which is United States versus Ortiz. Ms. Bruno?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Bruno, and I represent the appellant, Tomas Ortiz. Mr. Ortiz is asking the court to grant him a new trial because the district court erred in admitting evidence of his other bad acts. Mr. Ortiz was tried for possession of a firearm by a felon. The government's case was built on the testimony of William Ortiz, an old friend of Thomas's. William was cooperating with the government in order to avoid a life sentence in his pending drug case. William testified that he obtained a gun from Thomas, who was barred from possessing firearms because of a previous felony conviction. William taped a couple conversations he had with Thomas, including one in which William says that he asked Thomas if he could borrow a gun. The tape records William asking, "You let me use one of your toys to do something." William then testified in court that by toys, he meant guns, and by do something, he meant stick up a drug dealer. On cross-examination, defense counsel asked him about this. He asked him whether he'd actually used the words guns or whether he'd actually mentioned sticking up a drug dealer when talking to Thomas, and William answered no, that he had not used those words. The government argued that defense counsel's question opened a door to other bad act evidence, specifically that William and Thomas stuck up a drug dealer, robbed a cocaine dealer at gunpoint 6 years earlier, and then sold the stolen cocaine. The government argued that the evidence was relevant to Thomas's motive to possess the gun on this occasion and was also relevant to explain why Thomas would understand the code language that William was using. The district court allowed in the evidence, but that ruling was wrong. First, the evidence had absolutely no probative value in this case. It certainly wasn't relevant to Thomas's motive. It doesn't make sense to say that Thomas was motivated to possess a gun in 2003 because of a prior finished incident 6 years earlier. That can't provide a motivation to possess a gun 6 years later. It also wasn't relevant to explain why Thomas would understand the code language that William was using. We could imagine how it could be relevant if William testified that they made up that code language for the prior incident and then were still using that code language later, but he didn't testify to that at all. He didn't make any connection between the prior incident and the code words he was using to allegedly ask for the gun for this incident. There was no connection. So the prior stick-up had no probative value in this case. And even if it did, the danger for unfair prejudice was substantial. It painted the picture of Thomas as a violent thief, someone who would stick up a drug dealer with a gun. It painted the picture of him as a drug dealer himself because William testified that they sold the stolen cocaine. So it painted the picture of him as a criminal. So that the danger of unfair prejudice was substantial and substantially outweighed any probative value that there might have been.
Assuming all that is correct, isn't this all harmless error in this case?
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't think it was harmless error in this case.
It's overwhelming evidence of guilt, isn't it?
Well, I think the weak spot in the government's case was their expert on the interstate commerce connection. They had Agent Casey testify that the gun was manufactured by Sturm Ruger and that Sturm Ruger manufactures its guns in Southport, Connecticut. And, of course, then he testified that it was his opinion that the gun had to travel across state lines. That alone would have been very strong testimony. However, on cross-examination, defense counsel asked him how many gun manufacturers were in the state of Illinois, and he answered that there were 200. And then counsel asked him whether Sturm Ruger had ever contracted with one of those 200 manufacturers for the manufacturing of the 22 caliber handguns. And he answered, "I have no knowledge of that, no." His answer was ambiguous.
But his original testimony on direct was clearly that it came from Massachusetts. Did you have any evidence submitted that it didn't come that way? It was contract, that model gun?
No, but I think the his original opinion was undermined by defense counsel's question and his answer that, you know, that no, he didn't have knowledge about the subcontracting practices.
May have been somewhat undermined, but it didn't change, though, did it?
He never said that he changed his opinion, but the question and his ambiguous response showed that his opinion was not as strong as he suggested that it was. I mean, he never said...
And I'm sure the jury was instructed to find that the gun traveled in interstate commerce?
Well, they were...
It went to the weight of the evidence, didn't it? I mean, they didn't show that he was incorrect, but they raised a possibility, the defense counsel raised a possibility, that it might have come someplace other than interstate commerce.
Right, absolutely.
But the jury chose to believe that it did.
Right, and I think the problem in this case is that the jury chose to believe that because they had already seen the man in front of them, the defendant, in different ways being shown as a criminal. I think, you know, the jury... They may have doubts about the evidence. In fact, they had problems with this evidence. They asked for the testimony twice of Agent Casey to come back to the jury room so they could look at it. They obviously had some problems with this evidence. A jury that's not focusing on the fact that the defendant is already a criminal maybe would have resolved their doubts in the favor of the defendant. But this jury had two evidentiary errors, twice the testimony that I talked about, the prior stick-up, plus there was a videotape submitted of Thomas possessing marijuana. So they had this very powerful visual image of the defendant engaging in other irrelevant criminal activity.
But the asserted evidentiary errors don't have anything to do with the weakness in the government's case that you've identified, that being the interstate commerce element of this offense. It has to do with the possession element.
Well, I don't think that they have to. I think what happens is... If you have evidentiary errors, I mean, an evidentiary error, if irrelevant evidence is submitted, it never has to do with an element of the case. I mean, if evidence is let in incorrectly, it's irrelevant.
Well, to get back to Judge Cudahy's question, the evidence of possession here was extremely strong. And so even if the other acts evidence was improperly admitted, how does that constitute harmless error in this context?
Well, because there was a weak part in the government's case, and any weakness in the government's case, the jury may overlook any weakness in the government's case if they're focusing on the fact, or if they've stopped paying attention or stopped weighing the evidence carefully because they're thinking, well, this guy's a criminal. He did this before. He probably committed a crime again. I mean, that contains any part of a case, contains any weakness in the government's case if the jury is thinking that.
It requires an awful lot of speculation. And the weakness that's been identified is a marginal weakness on the interstate commerce element, not on the basic substance of whether the defendant possessed a gun.
Well,
if there were some weakness on the question of his possession of the gun, maybe you could demonstrate harmful error, but...
I think the question of harmful or harmless error always requires some amount of speculation because the question is, you know, what would the jury have done if they didn't have this prejudicial evidence clouding their judgment? I think that's always, you're always wondering, you know, what would happen if things were different, if the errors weren't made. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Bruno. Mr. Porter?
Good morning. Counsel is correct that this case was built on the testimony and the undercover work of William Ortiz. But the issue here and how we got to the point of introducing the evidence of the 1998 stick-up was we collectively had agreed that evidence was not going to be introduced at trial, subject to cross-examination. And the cross-examination, as defense counsel points out in her reply brief, left the jury unclear whether Tomas Ortiz really did understand William Ortiz's code words. That's the argument that they make in the reply brief. The inference from the cross-examination, because the questions were, you never used the word gun, you never used the word stick up, you never used this word, this word, this word, ever in your conversations with him. So that the inference the inescapable inference really is he may not have known that what you were talking about was a gun. And coupled with the cross-examination of you had a big motive to help yourself because you were facing life in prison, you planted this gun. That's where that trail of questioning goes. And so because that was injected, because that was put into the case by defense counsel, it was appropriate. It was appropriate on the issue of motive, the motive to possess the gun, this collaboration between the two Ortizes, and it was relevant and admissible on the issue of the defendant's knowledge, his knowledge of what was being talked about here, because they were both using code words, talking about this thing, talking about, are you going to do one of these things? That's what Tomas Ortiz, the defendant, said. So it was permissible when there was that cross-examination, and it was relevant to introduce that evidence. In terms of...
Well, the evidence was just that you participated in this crime some years back, but it's a little hard to follow how that connects with whether they were using the same code.
Well, the issue, Judge, I think, is what we're trying to do here is to try to figure out and to try to tell the story to the jury. What do these words mean? What do these two individuals who know each other very well, what do they mean when they're talking about this? And we had agreed not to introduce that prior evidence if they didn't open the door. But when he started asking the questions, you never mentioned this, you never did this, you never mentioned stick-up, it was appropriate for the jury to understand the entire story and the entire context of their relationship. And their relationship did include this, or at least William Ortiz testified to that and was subject to cross-examination on that, did include this history between them. And it was appropriate to give the jury that context when that door was opened, when the inference from the defendant's questions was that Tomas Ortiz didn't know what his friend William Ortiz was talking about when they were talking about a toy and doing something. In terms of the marijuana, the videotape, counsel in her brief had acknowledged that the door was opened because there was a flurry of questioning about William Ortiz attempting to buy narcotics from Tomas Ortiz, and that went at some point in terms of the argument that he's planting the gun. That evidence proved, established, and it only came in after the cross-examination, established that they did have that relationship and Tomas Ortiz was involved in that business. In terms of the expert, in terms of the interstate commerce issue, I would submit that that evidence was not weak. That evidence was very strong. The defendant's opinion, or the agent Casey's opinion, was very strong and very clear that this gun had been manufactured in Connecticut and brought to Illinois thereafter. The questioning on cross-examination, the answer was, I have no knowledge of that. No. There was nothing else introduced by the defense at all that this gun could have been manufactured or subcontracted to someone in Illinois. And the further basis for the questioning was, you're aware, sir, aren't you, that some people who own guns take them apart and manufacture them in their basements and in their garages. That was where that testimony was going. So the evidence there was very strong, and to your point, Your Honor, in terms of what we're going to here, we're talking about possession, and that's not connected to the interstate commerce element of this case, where Agent Casey's testimony was very strong. Your Honors, we would respectfully request that you affirm Judge Bucklow's evidentiary rulings at trial and affirm the conviction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Porter. Ms. Bruno, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Ms. Bruno.
Thank you. Just real quick, counsel talked about the videotape of Thomas possessing marijuana, and it's true, we acknowledged in the brief that defense counsel did open the door to that evidence. It became relevant to the witness, Williams' credibility. However, that's not the end of the analysis. You have to also consider whether the evidence was more prejudicial than probative. And again, I think the probative value was minimized by the fact that the government first asked William, why did you think you could buy drugs from Thomas? And he was able to answer that question. He answered that Thomas told him he was selling heroin in 2003. So to go further and submit a videotape of Thomas possessing marijuana, was the extra probative value of that was negligible. And again, the danger for unfair prejudice is substantial given the fact that the jury had the visual image of Thomas committing a crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. You took this case by appointment, did you? You have the thanks of the court for your excellent representation of your client. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.